All right.
This meeting is being live streamed. This is Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlyle, joined as always by my co-host Jake Taylor. Our special guest today is Vitaly Katsanilson. How are you, sir?
Hey, Toby, Jake, great. I'm a big fan, actually. No, this is the first time I ever did a live podcast ever.
Well, that's cool.
I did live TV, which I really don't like doing. This is the first time I did live podcast.
Try to keep the F-bombs to a minimum, Vitaly.
Oh, it's very difficult for me to do that, obviously. But yes, that's right. Yeah.
Welcome.
Well, thank you guys. I'm really excited.
Hey, it's a little, your book's been out for a little while, but congrats on the new book. I've been meaning to get you on to talk about it. What's it called, Vitaly?
Yeah,
Do you have one within
so yeah,
reach?
well, no,
Soul in the Game?
that you, it's funny that you mentioned. I have a copy right here.
What were the
So
odds?
Upside down, upside down. Turn around the
yeah,
right way.
huh?
I know it's
It's
your
the camera's
camera's.
inverted, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's Soul in the Game. But by the way, we don't have to talk about the book. We can talk about anything you want because I'll be honest. The problem, if you think about Eagles for a second, the when you think about them, you probably only think about one song, right? Hotel California. So I want to be known for more than just my books. And so we don't have to talk about my books. We can talk about anything else you guys want to talk about.
Well, let's start with the book. What's
Okay.
the book about? Just tell us a little bit about what the book's about.
Yes. No, so the over the years I've written a lot of articles about investing, but I also ended up writing many articles about topics that are unrelated to investing completely, about parenting, travel, philosophy, classical music. And the problem when you write articles, they kind of people read them and then they kind of disappear. So I wanted to leave something more permanent behind me. So original idea was to take these articles and kind of put them into edit them and put them into a book. But Toby and Jake, you guys know because you both write. When you start working on something, you
Poorly.
start writing. Well, I mean, Toby obviously wrote many books. Jake, you should write a book.
Jake wrote one good one.
Oh, you did write a book. Jake, you wrote a book.
Jake didn't take 10
Oh,
goes to
of
get it right.
course.
He
What am
just
I
did one
talking
good one.
about? Jake wrote a
One
book.
and done.
Well, no, I mean, yeah. So anyway, I wanted to leave something permanent behind. So when I started writing it, when I started kind of editing these articles and put them together, it's kind of the writer in me took over, and I ended up writing like half of the book. Like it was supposed to be just a collection of the articles. I ended up, and that's what it is about. It's just basically about life advice, kind of, by a guy who should not be given life advice, basically. Yeah, but that's still in the game. Yeah.
To what extent is it influenced by your investment career or the way that you invest, your philosophy?
Or how bad value was there for a 5-year stretch?
Oh, okay. That's actually, you know what? I think this is Jake just nailed it. I think that's a, it's more, it's a, there were some influences there of pain and a lot less about me being a value investor. I guess maybe it's both, right? But it's basically, there was a chapter there where I talk about very painful period in 2015, 2016, where I went through very difficult investment strategy and how I dealt with pain. So that chapter was influenced. Other chapters really unrelated to investing. And I know, Toby, I think you're working on the book on Stoic philosophy, right?
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's
what are you doing there?
I've finished it. I've got it out. I've given it a copy to Guy Spear. He's having a look at it for me and he's going to pass it on to somebody. But if that doesn't come out through an agent, it'll come out. I'll just self-publish and it's ready to go. I can just basically push the button. I've got the cover done and it's ready to go.
Okay.
But it's more Sun Tzu than general philosophy. Sun Tzu and then associated philosophies.
Gotcha. All right. Well, so this one has talks about like maybe one third of the book talks about Stoic philosophy.
Yeah, I went
And
down a little the stoicism and then I saw your book and I thought, I'll leave that to Vitaly. I won't try.
yeah, no, I know. When I talked, you said, listen, I'm working on the book of Stoic philosophy. I don't want to read it because I don't want it to, I don't, yeah, no, I get, no, I get, I, and I respect that. No, but the point I want to make is that one thing you can, and as an investor, you can take away from Stoic philosophy is the dichotomy of control, right? Because, the dichotomy of control basically says some things are up to us, some things aren't. Well, let's apply it to investing. What's up to us is basically our research, our process. which influences our behavior, basically. Everything else is not up to us. And I think that's probably, like, if you ask me what's one concept you can apply from Stoics to investing, it's that. It's a just focus on process and long-term the outcome will follow. But just know that you have absolutely no control if the stock market wakes up this morning and decides to price your stocks 20% lower.
And maybe that ties into another book that you wrote, which was The Little Book of Sideways Markets. Where's
active investing before then, right?
Where are we at right now on sideways markets?
I got both of them right here, like this one and this one. I don't know how they got
Hold them up, Vitaly. Hold them up.
Boy. I don't know. I got some props here. Okay.
No, that's good.
No, so active value investing, I started working on it in 2005. I finished it in 2007. And it's basically, the thesis of the book is very simple. Historically, every single time when you had a loan loss in bull market, when price earnings went up a lot, the market that followed was kind of a sideways markets, a sideways market. Basically, as price earnings went from above average to average to below average, it's offset any benefits the economy got or stocks got from earnings growth. And that was kind of my thesis. And I think it looked accurate for about maybe the mid 2013, 2015. And then as interest rates went to zero, we basically went from sideways markets into a new secular bull, because price, today obviously price earnings are at historically probably the highest level since Great Depression, right, or something, or pre-Great Depression.
We're in that range on a cyclically adjusted basis, on the CAPE basis.
Exactly. You can argue that maybe profit margins should be higher today than they were before, and directionally that's true. But should they be so much higher than they are before? And then also you can argue that the profit margins historically have benefited from globalization and low interest rates. Well, now we're going through a very painful period of deglobalization, which should probably start compressing profit margins. And obviously, interest rates are going higher now than they were even a year and a half ago. And another factor, obviously, corporate profit margins. I mean, corporate taxes, which are basically Trump took them down. So we'll see where they're going to be in the future. My thesis was, the environment is going to be different than we are accustomed to. We're going to be in a sideways market. Here's how you invest. And that was basically the thesis of my active value investing. And then Wiley came to me and said, Vitaly, this book has literally, I forget, 75 charts and tables. Can you please kind of simplify it for your traditional kind of your neighborhood dentist? And so this is why this book came about. It's basically this book simplified. And this one has literally four charts and tables. Like, that's it. That's the whole thing. One thing I got to tell you about writing a little book, it is a much better literary work than the first book. And you guys both wrote books. Because when you start editing down, you figure out what's important, what's not. And it's just a easier book to read. But there is no way I could have written the little book unless I wrote the active value investing first.
Yeah, you need that forcing function to distill down into the core.
Also, there is another factor which is kind of unique to this project, confidence. Because when I make the point, this is why we're going to be in a sideways markets. In the active value investing, this is why I had 75 charts and tables to prove that, to make my point, right? When I was writing the little book, my internal thinking was, if somebody challenges me, I say, well, just read my first book. And it was really just psychological element. It just me being having self-confidence to write, I could write that little book because I already written the first one, which has all the data.
Vitaly, let me just give a shout out to the folks, and then we'll come back and talk about how you see the markets right now. But Santa Domingo, first in the house. What's up, Danny? Winter Park, Florida. Valparaiso. Love it. Brandon, Mississippi. Dubai, Belfast. Sherwood, Oregon. Milwaukee.
Say hi to
Missouri. Missouri City, Texas. Mendocino, California. Is that Mendocino Farms? Is that where that's from? Nijmegen, Netherlands. Milton Keynes. Savonlinna Finden. I just jumped over a whole lot. Sorry. Porto de Mos, Portugal. Nice. I'm going to come visit you. Ottawa, Tallahassee. Wilmette through a VPN. London, Chapel Hill, Cleveland, Hamburg, Germany, Wyoming, Nashville.
My God.
People want their book of veggies, Jake. Jupiter, Florida, Kennesaw, London. Bendigo, Germany. What's up? Good to see everybody. Fatali, where are we in the market? We've taken off into a new secular bull. What do you think?
Very unlikely. I mean, the historically secular bull market started when valuations were much, much lower. Because for the bull market to start, basically, this podcast has to be canceled. And nobody wants it much. No, let me put it this way. You and Jake will still be doing the podcast and it will be watched by a homeless guy in San Francisco or something. You know?
We're already there.
But basically, the fact that you have so many people from all over the world still watching this podcast, that in itself says that we are not in the kind of in the beginning of the bull market. Because it's just basically people have to throw in the towel and say, I don't want to own stocks ever again. It's when you have this moment of despair where the stock basically gave you no returns for a long period of time, when the price to earnings basically declined, and you bought a stock which you thought was cheap at 12 times earnings, and now it's trades at 7, and you're like, you know what, this stocks thing is just not working. And this is when the despair happens, that's when the new bull market starts, cyclical bull market starts. We are so far away from, you know, from the cyclical bull market. So we are at the end, but I want to be ambiguous end. I'm not saying this is the point where it ends. I'm just saying we are in the territory where it ends. But I have known, you know, obviously nobody knows how long it's going to last. Yeah, I mean, it's a, yeah.
I was at an Easter lunch over the weekend, and one of the guys there said, I've traded 3 crypto cycles, and we're into the degenerate phase of this crypto cycle.
Really?
So
those happen fast. Huh?
Yeah.
Digital crypto. World is cryptos. Yeah, it's like dog years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everybody, so I talked to everybody what they were holding. Everybody's got a big chunk of NVIDIA. They're all kicking themselves because they missed out on SMCI. Is that the silicon?
Yeah.
Got the ticker wrong there. One of the hotter kind of...
You know, it's kind of interesting. I remember I got into, like, I became an analyst. I was in industry in 1995, but I joined this company in 1997, and I was an analyst at that time. And I observed the dot-com bubble kind of firsthand. And I remember, like, I was meeting with somebody, at the time, the guy said, you can't go wrong owning, and he listed like a series of stocks. And like there was Cisco's, Oracle's, Dell's, I think it was, maybe AMD was part of the, you know, the pack. And like, you can't go wrong owning the stocks. And he was right for about maybe 2 years, maybe for a year. And then they all collapsed. You obviously know how the story ended. So it's this mentality that you can go wrong owning the stocks. And by the way, you can go back to Nifty 50s and it's, you know, same thing.
One decision.
No, you're right. One decision stocks, which is kind of a first level thinking, right? Because you're only, first of all, it's not even first level thinking. It's zero level thinking because all you're looking at is the stock price. Nothing else. Okay. And the stock price tells you anything, any story you want to, you know, you want to hear, like, you know, how NVIDIA, you know, how great. By the way, and the irony of this whole thing is, internet was real, right? It's just like Cisco still probably hasn't recovered, or maybe barely recovered from what happened 25 years ago.
I think it's still under, if I remember right, but I could be wrong.
Cisco got cheap a few years ago, though. I think Cisco was cheapish, but yeah, you're right. It's not.
No, no, but it just took.
Just in terms
it's
of the stock price.
No, it's not. I'm just talking about stock price. In other words, Cisco was a great business in. Okay, here is the punchline. Cisco was a great business in 1999, and it's good business today still. It's just it was incredibly overvalued in 1999, and it took a long time for the company to grow into its earnings. So how much you pay actually matters. And when you have a one decision stock, people actually ignore how much they pay. They just look at the stock. They just look at the chart, actually, not even that, you know, nothing else.
Yeah, you always feel good buying those stocks right at the point that you buy them, and then you regret it down the road. Whereas value stocks are the other way around. You feel terrible when you buy value stocks. You feel like you've made a terrible mistake. Usually when you wake up the next day and it's down another 20%. But it's subsequently, it's when you get disgusted at it and you can't check the ticker anymore, that's when it sort of comes back to life.
Yeah, there is a when you buy like there's a the love is not like the like this universal love for stocks is not cheap. Like when somebody hates something, that hate is cheap. But when somebody loves something, if everybody loves a stock, it's that stock is not cheap, and therefore the returns won't be good either, in just a general rule.
So what do you think is interesting now? Do you talk about individual stocks or sectors, or how do you?
Yeah, so let me talk about one sector, and we like, but it's kind of a tricky discussion because we like the I own 7 stocks in this sector, and most of them are not buys anymore, but we did buy a few stocks in the sector. But I'm going to talk about on a high level defense stocks. Literally 1/4 of my portfolio today is in the companies in the defense sector. And I look at from a portfolio construction perspective, to me, it makes so much sense. And 25% position, that's a large position again, but it covers 7 companies in 4 different countries, okay? But if you look over the last 30 years, we basically were living on the peace dividend, like, you know, especially European countries, right? Because if you look at the German defense spending, which is Germany's largest economy in Europe, it's basically declining every year. But that's true for every single country in Europe. Maybe there's a few exceptions, but I don't think that's been true. And today we have basically 2 wars going on. We have, you know, war in continental Europe, and we have a war in the Middle East, which could become a bigger war. And Europe for a long time basically looked at the United States and said, you know what? Yes, first of all, we don't have to be afraid of Russia anymore. Well, that changed. But second of all, US will protect us. No matter who is going to get elected in November, Europe does not look at the United States and says and thinks they will protect us. Because we kind of becoming a fickle friend. Like, you know, it's just like, look, like when Trump comes out and says, basically, by the way, you can argue for, there was some validity to what he said, that you guys did not invest, you know, like, you know, you cannot really count on us. You know, if you're spending, it's not really fair. Let me put it this way. I'm struggling here a little bit because I really don't want to go into politics. So this is not what I'm trying to do. But let me put it this way. You have an alliance, and the cost of entering into alliance is that we're going to spend on defense and you're going to spend on defense. So if we have to fight together, we're going to be both strong. Yeah, we're going to put our forces together and we're going to fight together. If we keep spending money on defense and you are not, and if the war comes, we basically going to carry the burden of not just financial, but also our lives. Okay, so it's on Trump's point, actually, I agree with this. What he said before, you can't keep relying on us and not spending on defense. Now, my problem is actually, my problem is that the way he communicated it when he ran for president, who basically says, well, if, you know, if you get attacked, you know, good luck. I have an issue with that. But anyway, long story short, I think European companies today, European governments today, waking up to this, and their defense spending will skyrocket. It's going from extremely low level, and it has to stay actually above average level to catch up for the last 30 years of underspending. So when you look at earnings projections for these companies, I would, you know, the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, they're probably too low. And the reason for that, think about, because it takes a while for your willingness to increase your spending on defense to actually to materialize. Because first of all, politicians have to agree. Second of all, the bill has to be passed. Then it has to be funded. Then the companies, because they're building atoms and electrons. So it takes stuff to build these factories. And by the way, European companies today are still struggling from supply chain issues. Like I was in a BAE conference call, and they're talking about how small defense companies, like, you know, their tiny suppliers, are still struggling from the pandemic supply chain issues. And BAE and other companies have to actually infuse funds for working capital, etc., to help them. So my point is, the demand is there, but it's going to take a while for it to materialize in earnings. And this is why, you know, like we bought these companies, some of them appreciate it a bunch, but we're not selling them because I think they're just, the earnings are going to end up being higher than we expect. Oh, and one little factoid, UK used to have, you know, the largest navy in Europe. Today, it has half as many ships than it did 20, 30 years ago. And if you think about it,
today, are they twice as good, Vitaly?
Huh? Yeah, hedonic adjustments.
They're not twice as good. Yeah, and the interesting part, it's a very aging fleet, and today they're facing not just threat from Europe. I mean, not from Russia, but also threat from China and from a whole bunch of pirates or Houthis or whoever, who are basically now attacking their cargo ships.
Yeah, having piracy come back was not one of the things that I was expecting.
On your bingo card. Well, that's, I mean, Peter Zeihan's thesis is that the U.S. is kind of potentially done playing world Navy police. And if everyone else then has to kind of carry their own water a little bit there, like they're not really prepared for that.
Well, exactly. And they therefore, like safety right up there in the kind of our basic human needs in the Maslow hierarchy of needs. And therefore be going to push our social security to 121 years from whatever it is today, but we're going to keep funding our defense. And so is true for European countries.
But Taylor, you're a value investor who thinks about value as a sort of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about, we did go through this very long period of sort of underperformance,
mm-hmm.
Maybe justified because we got too stretched in 2015. Everything cheap sort of got pushed up. Yeah, it wasn't that cheap. It feels to me like we turned the corner in late 2020, but how do you feel? This year particularly has seen this sort of resurgence of the crypto, resurgence of, mm-hmm. NVIDIA and AI, which is there's clearly a lot of return there. There's a lot of earnings there, but there's also a lot of multiple expansion. Where do you think we are in the cycle?
What do you think about Toby's portfolio and why is it so good?
Well, so Toby, I'll be honest. See, okay, so I'm going to answer it from different perspectives. So right now, like when I look at the market overall is very expensive. I'm having harder time finding new stocks to buy. So in general, like in the market, it's just very little value in the market. Now, as a value style, and I think that's what you're referring to, I think you would think when interest rates go from 0 to 5 or 6%, value would be just absolutely, you would not see crypto bubble. You would not, well, actually you would just not see cryptos, not crypto bubbles. You would just not see cryptos. You would not see kind of Nvidia-like Actually, you know what? Actually, forget about Nvidia, forget about all the stuff. Like the Donald Trump's stock, like the whatever, the Truth Social. I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, that is insane. Like, if I could short a stock, that would be stocks to short.
Yeah.
I mean, you
Was it
guys
like
probably
$11
discussed it.
billion dollar valuation on what, how many, like, how much was it? 50 million of revenue or something?
Yeah, no. Oh, no. You're too generous.
I know, yeah.
$5 million of revenues, but
Five.
you're right about $50 million of losses. So
Maybe
you
that's
just,
what I saw.
and you put $8 billion on that, and you look at this, maybe if it's lucky, maybe it should trade, let's say, 20 times revenues. So that's $100 million, not 8 billion. Okay. So like you would not expect, like, when interest rates went up so much, you would not expect to see this kind of, like, a lot of bubbly stocks like this developing. So I'll be honest, I'm very confused. I'm like, if you and I had a conversation a year ago, and you would have said, if all interest rates go up from zero to this, what do you think? I would not have guessed it.
Equity melt up. Equity melt up was the first thing I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crypto.
I mean, Buffett did say in his last letter, like, that he thinks today has more of a speculative element to the market, like more of a gambling, like, kind of punting mentality than 30 years ago, which is rather impressive to me.
Do you think that's social media? Do you think, because there's this social element to investing where you see your friends getting rich and you follow them, but it was a little bit more scattered, and now it's sort of, it's so easy to, every time somebody has a big score, they get on social media and they pop some champagne and choose rich, all that sort of stuff.
Oh, I think actually that is an
Choose
excellent
rich.
point. Think about it.
You
It's
know that
you
dude? You
always
know who I'm talking
speculate.
about? Choose
No,
rich.
I just imagine that being the inverse of have fun staying poor.
I think it's satire, but I'm not entirely sure. The guy's like, he's doing it totally straight. That Nick.eth, the ETH, yeah, I think. It's
Wow.
funny stuff.
So
Wait, when value blows up, it'll be me. I'll be out there doing that. No, joking. Couldn't possibly.
Toby, like, think about it. Like in the. Usually these bubbles happen because you're competing with your neighbor, right?
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, now the only thing is you only
You
have
got
so many
global
neighbors,
neighbors.
but now you have your whole Facebook is your
Yeah.
neighbor, right? Now, and I think that's what it, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think
That question was from Tyler Farris, our unofficial producer. Good one, Tyler. What
yeah.
you think, JT? You want to sneak in some vegetables before the top of the hour? There's lots of demands for the book of vegetables. I have also been pushing JT to do this. So there are transcripts of all of these interviews. If someone wants to contact us and produce the Jake's Book of Veggies,
I've
drop
got
me
a
a
lot
note.
of other projects going on, so
Yeah.
maybe let JT get to it in good
That's
time.
well, I'm saying we'll find somebody who'll put it together for you.
Maybe. All right. Well, I'm going for this is like trying to stick the 10.0, like, triple backflip here
Oh.
today. So we'll see. This
Is
is
that getting it back to investing?
yeah. Well, that's not gonna happen, but I thought it would be fun with Italian just because I know that he understands a lot of this stuff. So I think hopefully this is a good choice of trying to match up content with the guests. But I'm going to give a little history lesson on the efficient market hypothesis
Love it.
and also try to relate that together with the four fundamental forces in physics. All
Okay,
right.
this will be good.
So yeah.
Phlogiston.
Yeah, buckle up. This could really blow up in my face. But all right, so the EMH, the quick history lesson is, like, starts really sort of with a 1900 PhD thesis by this guy named Louis Bachelier, and it was called the theory of speculation, and he suggested that stock market prices are unpredictable and follow a random path, laying the groundwork for what would later evolve into the EMH. And this is kind of where the term random walk came from. So if you imagine the thought process was, imagine a drunk that's fallen asleep at a lamppost, and every now and then he wakes up and he staggers a few steps in a random direction. You don't know which way he's going. And then he falls back down and it takes another nap. And then after many stages of this aimless wandering, how far away is the drunk from the lamppost? Well, we can't really say with any one drunk how far away he's likely to be, but if we had like a million of them, They would actually, we could start to actually look for patterns of how far away would we expect them to be on average. And it would be diffused outward in all directions. And the average distance from the lamppost would increase with the square root of time. And so that's kind of the math that would come out of that. So that's what people have used then to like back into like prices moving around in random ways. And what I mean by that square root of time thing. So if you think, if it takes 1 hour for him to wander one block, it would take 4 hours on average to wander two, and then 9 hours to wander three, because there's a lot of like backtracing, wandering around in circles. All right. So fast forward to the 1950s, and we start to get more of a foundation laid for EMH. And that's the legendary economist Paul Samuelson ran with this concept and suggested the stock market was a glorified casino. And people who make fortunes there are basically just lucky. They're not that smart. They're basically lotto winners. Funny enough, Samuelson hedged his personal bets by putting his own money in Berkshire Hathaway. fast forward, and then we have Harry Markowitz introduced the modern portfolio theory in 1952. And there he emphasized diversification and the relationship between risk and return, which set the stage even more for discussions on market efficiency. 1953, an economist named Maurice Kendall gave a talk indicating that wheat prices move around randomly, supporting the notion that markets are unpredictable and by extension, then efficient. And it was, you know, of course, wheat and stocks, there's not that much of a difference when you're looking at the squiggly lines. 1960s, we get a much more formal introduction and development with Eugene Fama in his PhD thesis at University of Chicago, 1965, formal introduction of the EMH. And he defined efficient markets as one where prices are always the fully reflect available information. And it really categorized into three forms, okay? Weak, semi-strong, and strong. So let's look at each one. The weak version is you can't beat the market by predicting a stock's future prices just from knowing its past prices. Okay. That basically like destroys all technical analysis as worthless at that point when you say that the past is not prologue for the future. Semi-strong is you say you can't beat the market with any publicly available information. So every past price, every press release, every filing, Bloomberg story, whatever. And however good you are at interpreting these things, there's no room left over. It's already all baked into the price, okay? And fundamental analysis then is completely worthless. The semi-strong.
I agree there.
Yeah, that's been the lesson for the last 7 years. it does leave room for private information in the semi-strong version, and then you have the strong form, which is. Private is also then included in the mix. And basically, like, you can't beat the market. Every piece of information, public and private, is already baked into the price. The implication is that basically insider trading is completely worthless. Fast forward 1970s, more studies are done to validate with mixed results. The markets seem to reflect public information quickly, which might support the semi-strong version, but you can never really get all the way to like fully strong version. 1980s, then we have a lot more challenges. You have anomalies such as the January effect. You end up with market crashes like 1987 that completely challenge EMH. Like, really, everything's worth 22% less from a Friday to a Monday, suggesting that maybe markets aren't perfectly efficient. You get the rise of behavioral finance, led by psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, which RIP Mr. Kahneman last week. Unfortunately, we lost a giant. And all that introduces this idea of cognitive biases, which affect investor decisions, which lead to potential inefficiencies. And then, of course, 1984, Buffett wrote The Super Investors of Graham and Doddsville, which is a direct parry against the challenges of EMH. Then, of course, in the 90s, you get technology, which this goes to what you guys were talking about with like the diffusion of information. Now that we're all connected on the internet, maybe markets are even more efficient. And yet, squared against that, we have the dot-com bubble in the 90s, which, like, you know, companies, you throw a dot-com on the end of the name and it turns into, you know, it adds $1 billion of market cap. Does that really make that much sense? Late 2000s, some of the same problems, you know, the GFC brings significant challenges to EMH. You know, failure to predict and prevent a bubble suggests that there's limitations in this efficiency. So anyway, systematic mispricing of a lot of risk at that point. And then since then, you know, despite the criticism, EMH still remains a fundamental part of financial theory. It's taught in every business school still, although there's still a little bit more room now for behavioral finance. Anyway, So analogously now, we're going to try to bring EMH together with the fundamental four forces in physics, which, to remind you of your classes from back in the day, number one is the strong nuclear force. Number two is the electromagnetic force. Number three is the weak nuclear force. And then number four is gravity. All right. So the first one, the strong nuclear force, let's kind of connect that together with market fundamentals. This strong nuclear force is the most powerful of the forces, and it acts as the glue that will hold nuclei of atoms together. Similarly, market fundamentals, earnings, debt levels, economic indicators, whatever, are kind of the glue that underpins the intrinsic value of securities. And just as a strong nuclear force operates at the smallest scales, but with the most intensity, fundamental analysis is at the core of the financial health of the company and often revealing the most potential indicators of long-term value. It's very powerful and up close, but it's also short range, right? So then the next one is electromagnetic force. And maybe we can liken this one to the information spread like we were talking about. And this is like attraction and repulsion is basically EMF. So imagine, you know, it governs how particles are either attracted or repelled to from each other. And in markets, information kind of acts similarly, where investors can be attracted to a stock or repelled from it based on the nature of the news, right? You see everybody's making money on NVIDIA, you get attracted to it. Everyone hates oil companies, you would never buy that. Like, you get repelled from it and you get these dislocations. and then it influences over a distance, right? Like, unlike the strong nuclear force, which is very up close, electromagnetic force works over vast distances. And this kind of mirrors how information, you know, especially in the age of the internet, can spread globally in an instant and affect markets worldwide. Next up, weak nuclear force. And maybe this relates to market anomalies. So, you know, the weak nuclear force is essentially the process of changing one particle into another. So imagine like radioactive decay. Analogously, like market anomalies, bubbles, flash crashes, things like that, can be seen as markets' radioactive decay, where there's the usual rules kind of stop applying temporarily, and challenging, I think, EMH's notion of a perfectly always efficient market. They're rare and unpredictable. You know, the weak nuclear force is responsible for phenomena that are really pretty uncommon and very unpredictable, compared to gravity and these other things, which are much more regular. And similarly, market anomalies are pretty rare and often unpredictable. And then the last one is gravity and, I would say, and interest rates. So, you know, gravity is the force of attraction between all masses in the universe. And much like interest rates, it acts like the gravity of the financial universe, right? Like everyone, Buffett said that a million times, that gravity is interest rates are the gravity of the financial universe. So... on an interest rates, they may seem kind of weak and irrational on an individual company basis. I mean, of course, you know, interest expense makes sense, but for the most part, but on a macro scale, they have very profound and far reaching impact. Like, they get into every little nook and cranny of the economy. So the gravitational pull, like it decays much faster the further you get away. And so the same kind of idea. Anyway, all of this is like the interplay of these forces. You know, the universe operates under the influence of all four of these fundamental forces, and financial markets are shaped by complexity and the interplay of factors, from hardcore fundamentals to market sentiment to all this to these other things. So, anyway, hopefully, maybe we got a little bit of EMH background that was history, that was interesting, the history of it, and then the four forces and trying to weave those together to talk about the interplay. I would give this a 6 out of 10 landing. I don't know. We have a Russian judge on. what's the Russian judge put it at?
Oh, nice. I like that. Okay. That's right. I mean, Jake, your ability to come up with this mental models is just incredible. I mean, it's really.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I mean, and you should write a book. I mean, on this, seriously. I always thought of, like, the reason EMH was taught, because it was, you can basically take any physics teacher, give him a textbook, and 3 hours he can teach investments.
Right.
Teaching value investing is a lot more difficult.
And the math is so elegant on the,
yeah,
the
no,
EMH,
exactly.
Right?
It's the elegance in formulas. And in the... And it's so addictive because it's so, it is like you, like I remember when I took when I had undergraduate, when I took my undergraduate classes in, in the finance, I remember how I was blown away by brilliance, the simplicity of this. And then the irony of this, I showed up at this office and I was prepared and nobody cared.
Yeah, where's our efficient frontier,
Yeah,
guys?
exactly. Exactly. And the like you know we talked, I think if applying your frameworks, like in yeah, so the when you look at NVIDIA today, or forget about it, if you look at that, what is it, Truth Social, is that priced to reflect all the correct information right now? I mean, let's find out when it's going to be 90%, in 6 months. So it's, to me, I look at this as just because, well, first of all, just because something is easy to teach doesn't mean it should be taught. Okay. But I like these frameworks, and it's just, that you come up with and how they interact with one each other. Because at some point in time, one framework dominates, and another point of time, another one dominates, right? When interest rates are low, then probably what was the framework? That the gravity framework probably becomes,
Yeah.
like it
You're on the
becomes.
moon
It's like
at that
switching
point
off
then.
gravity.
Yeah, so it's like it doesn't matter, right? When interest rates go up, suddenly that's all that matters.
You're on
And I
Jupiter.
think this is actually kind of an important point, which is, by the way, I'm changing topic just slightly, but I'm just really surprised how well our economy is doing so far with higher interest rates. Because I would have thought that when interest rates went up as they did, like basically, like all the capital budgets would be reflect new high interest rates, and a lot of them would have been canceled. And I think it just maybe takes time for the interest rates
Yeah.
to kind of the
I mean,
impact to get into the.
corporate America, the S&P 500 did a really good job of locking in low and long. So I
Yes.
think so far they've went from, if last I saw it was like 3.2 to like 3.9. It's like they've barely noticed that rates
Yeah.
went up.
And you see, and you like you see in our companies, right? A lot of them, like we own Charter. Well, I think, or actually, let me take a better case, Enterprise Products, which is a pipeline company, and I think they have a huge amount of debt, but they also have a very stable cash flows. But if you look at that debt, it's spread out like maturing like $1 billion a year or something over 40 years. So interest rates could quadruple tomorrow, and it's not going to matter for them. Right. So it's a, but so you, I think corporate America, you're right, I think adopted that a lot better, unlike our very smart government,
Yeah.
which actually I think went the other way. So we're going to probably see that, the impact in our money printing a lot sooner than, we
Yeah.
would have liked. Anyway,
You
so I
know
didn't mean to.
who else borrowed short and variable?
I'm sorry?
I said, do you know who else borrowed short and variable?
Cool.
Private equity.
Oh yeah, no, that's, and we haven't felt that yet.
Vitaly, how do you square the idea that markets aren't efficient in that the academic version of efficient markets, but clearly we do rely on some efficiency in markets because we all buy things that are undervalued with the expectation that they will be fairly valued at some point in the future, which sort of means that we also think that there's some efficiency in the markets. And we wouldn't expect most of the things that we look at to be undervalued. We would expect most things to be fairly valued in a very wide range, and then there's some that are overvalued because they're hot or popular, and then there are some that are undervalued because they're neglected or scary. So how do you square that non-academic version of efficiency with the academic one that's taught in all of the universities?
I think the a lot of like the when new information comes out, a lot of times it's a properly reflected in the stock. A lot of times it gets you have a time arbitrage, so or yeah, I like to call it pain arbitrage. Who is willing to suffer the uncertainty you have over the next 2 years, where all the reward comes for in 5 years, right? So I think markets are not efficient. Markets are efficient. And what I mean by this, kind of reflect available information most of the time, not all the time. And I think what you and I bet in, Toby, is that when we are buying, when we buy in stocks, we are buying them at the point where not all it, like not, were they inefficient, but at some point they'll get to that efficiency. Where, in other words, Seneca has this saying, which I love, time discovers truth. So when you and I do research, and Jake too, we want to discover truth before time does, right? So if you think the company is going to earn $5 in 5 years, or whatever that number is, and right now the company is earning a lot less for whatever random reasons, if you're going to be, if you think you are right about the $5 of earnings, and then a 10 times earning, well, a 10 times multiple is worth 50, you know, the at some point market will get to this equilibrium state where it's going to value your company fairly, and it usually does. Historically, you almost have to have faith that in the long run, the company, if you are right about your thesis, then the company market will value it right. And I think it's just, but the journey to that could be extremely painful. I don't know if I'm doing a good job kind of answering.
Well, there's also the dividing line that the efficient market guys think that there's a risk element to, that's their explanation for under, you know, the reason that these stocks are, they generate higher returns because it's compensation for additional risk. And they're talking about operating risk in that context, but there's also a financial risk component to it. And then the behavioral guys would say, well, no, it's just, you know, there, we make these mistakes, we extrapolate earnings, and they either go to zero or they go to infinity, and we decide on that basis rather than mean reversion.
I think this is so true. And I think there are two factors here. Factor number one, actually, as the stock price declines, it's actually the stock becomes less risky as an investment, just because it's actually, you create high margin of safety. Yes, everything else being constant, right? As the stock, as the Nvidia stock price goes up, it actually becomes more riskier because it's more likely that the sun will not shine as bright as the stock price reflects. And there was a second point I was going to make, and I already forgot. So.
The behavioral element?
Behavioral. Yes, thank you. And behavioral element, exactly right. Because I think Bill Miller tells this joke all the time. Every time I hear him talk, he makes the same joke. It's like when you have, like somebody asks, when you have 10 sheep on this side of the fence, and one sheep jumps over, how many are you going to have left? And the answer is, zero, because they all move together, right? Well, it's a, you know, and so it's kind of the same thing here. Like we feel more comfortable as human beings to move this crowd. And therefore, it's so like when you, like, and you and I experience that too. When you buy something that's hated, you get this feeling of unease, right? It's just, I think it's a, it's an evolutionary feeling. It's a physiological feeling. So this is why you have to do so much more work to be confident in your research, because you're basically saying, I'm right and everybody else is wrong. And so...
Well, the risk is that there's something obvious that everybody else knows that you've completely missed.
Exactly.
And everybody knows it, and you're a fool when you put this thing on.
Yeah.
And then you find out subsequently, and you're like, yeah, that was dumb. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. But the problem is, I think the key word here is that when everybody knows, it's already, a lot of times it's already reflects.
It's baked in.
Yeah, it's already baked in. And I think this, then that's the behavioral finance comes in. So I think it's a lot more difficult to teach what we're not just discussing than to teach, like, you know, these very simple equations, you know, where you know that beta is 1.35, like this very precise math. It's so much easier to teach than what you and I are discussing right now.
What do you think, Jesse? How do you square those two?
I think that in general, I'm of the opinion that the market's pretty damn efficient most of the time.
Yeah.
Over most time frames too, actually. I think it generally gets most things right. However, occasionally it malfunctions to the upside and the downside. And if you can be patient and wait for the really obvious things to do that you understand, you don't actually have to be all that clever in an analysis, understanding. And I, you know, then you kind of lean a little bit on Buffett's observation that price is my due diligence. The cheaper it is, kind of the less you really have to understand about the future. If it's fully priced, then you better be damn right about the quality of the business, about the future prospects. But if it's cheap enough, yeah, I think if you know, own enough of those type of situations over a career, I think you'll do just fine. And you don't really have to be a towering genius to do that. So and the difference between perfectly efficient, like is you know, strong form, especially EMH, versus right most of the time, is night and day as far as what you should be working on every day if you're a security analyst.
I think you summed up perfectly, Jake.
Was the I always thought that the reason for insisting that market prices are perfectly efficient is the other alternative was the sort of command economy, the Russian communist style command economy, where they were, working out where everything should go from a central location. They said, no, that's the wrong approach. You've got to use markets because markets are perfectly efficient. That's a better way of doing it.
Like the market for money. And oh wait, no, we have pretty much command and control of
Well,
the
yeah.
temporal pricing of money.
There's not a lot of the economy that's not even Western economies, it's not heavily regulated. But yeah, I think that was it was like a philosophical argument that it had to be, that it had to be perfectly efficient.
Jake, I think there is a, you know, you could probably use this some kind of framework of complex systems, to kind of talk about this as well. Because that's another framework to look at the efficiency. And you don't like it's a like it's a, despite writing two books on the markets, I think the best way to look at this is just kind of look at individual stocks. To me, it makes so much more sense. Because it's just so ambiguous. What is the market, right? It's really just individual stocks. And because when I look, when you try to time the market, I think then I would agree with the efficient market theory. It's incredibly difficult because you need to get the economy right, and you have to get the reaction, you have to get the reaction right as well. And getting both of them right is incredibly difficult. So I think the I'm not sure where market timing falls into this, but I would argue that's a fool's errand. It's a all three of us could talk about this, right? This kind of stuff. And it's a but then I would do absolutely nothing about it. I would just go, I would just, kind of go back to my balance sheets and income statements and building models and just keep looking at individual stocks.
Vitaly, can we talk about Tesla for a little bit? Because I know that you did a write-up about Tesla. Tesla's one of those interesting stocks that it was running out of money at one point, but because it had such a high stock price, Musk was able to take advantage of that, maybe that idea of a little bit of self-reflexivity. It's an example of self-reflexivity in the market where the high stock price made it possible for them to raise some money, which probably got rid of that blow-up risk at that time, and it's gone on to do very well. Your article came out at a pretty timely. That was a pretty good entry point, I think, for that stock. Do you still hold it? Can you talk
No,
to us a little
actually,
bit
just
about?
let me just yeah, let me clarify a few. Okay, let me embarrass myself that I literally wrote a little booklet, which I don't have a prop, but it's a you can actually get it on Amazon for $3 or something in 2018, but basically literally writing 7,000 word research paper on Tesla
So it
after
came out
voting
in
among
2018. Wow.
2018, 20 yeah,
God, it
2018.
feels like it was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, I would have said it's a much more recent than that.
Damn
Yeah,
it.
no, and basically my argument was like I saw a lot of positive in Tesla, and I also saw a lot of risks. And my conclusion was it was a path dependent company.
Yeah.
And I was right in the sense that the path dependency was if they can get to escape velocity, then they will going to be incredibly successful. And in escape velocity, that means in this case, man, they have to get to the cash flow positive without going bankrupt, okay, or diluting the hell out of the shareholders. And this is where Musk's magic comes in, right? He basically creates a religion behind it. And Jeremy Grantham, you know, described that part brilliantly. So basically Musk says, come out and said, we're gonna issue shares. If it was any other company, the stock price would have declined. In this case, the stock price actually went up because like the cult basically says, oh, this is great. We're going to issue shares. The company is going to survive. Let's buy more shares. I mean, it don't think it ever has ever happened in history, though I'm sure there are exceptions. But that's exactly what happened. And then you know, they did get to escape velocity. And so I never owned the stock. I owned two cars. Never owned the stock. It's a kind of one of those things where instead of buying the first iPhone, you should have bought the stock. I mean, I'm sorry. It's kind of the same thing. You know, you would have a lot more money to buy a lot more, 100 more iPhones. Well, I could have, you know, I should have bought a, you know, I should have bought the stock instead of, you know, buying a car, I guess. And I would argue today, I just actually wrote about this, and maybe that's what you're referring to. Like a few months ago, I wrote about this, that I think today we reached the point where kind of peak electric cars. And let me qualify this. This is very important. Today, electric cars are basically about 15 to 20% of new car sales. And I would argue that everybody who wanted to buy an electric car already owns one. And let me explain you, this is a very important point. Basically, people who bought the car, you know, kind of, you know, the people like me who like the electric car, and I really do, I like how it drives. But for me, it's one of two, you know, I also have an ICE car as a backup if I need to do a long distance travel. I live in a house, so therefore I have a gas station basically in my garage. I commute mostly locally. And I don't have like into the, because today the owner, the, you know, basically three things that work against electric cars, probably more than that. It's a range anxiety. Because today you have a 300 miles if you're lucky on an electric car. If it's too hot, it's going to get to 200. If it's too cold, it gets to 200. It takes a long time to charge it, so it's not very good. It's still not a great for a long distance commute. And finally, the infrastructure is kind of sucks. Tesla has the best infrastructure, but if you buy a car from General Motors or somebody else, well, now you can use Tesla's infrastructure, but the infrastructure outside of Tesla is not very good. So my argument is this: unless we have a technological shift in battery technology, in charging, and the infrastructure, this is where the market share will stay. Toyota talks about how by 2027, they're gonna have a car that's gonna have 600 mile range. And then by 2030, like 900 mile range. Who knows if it's true or not? But my point is, once we get to this kind of levels, this is where the adoption will increase tremendously. If at this level of technology, we're basically at 15% or 20% of new car sales. And it's going to stay here for a long time, basically, if that doesn't change.
I don't want to make you feel bad, Vitaly, but Tesla was about $20 in 2018. Funnily enough, it's 166 today. It's off 5% today. So you would have missed out on that 5% drop today.
Okay, dodge that bullet.
Think about this. I could have basically bought eight cars. I would have had eight cars instead of one. Yeah, so that's just, yeah.
Yeah, it's down 30% for the year. It hasn't had much of a year so far this year.
Well, and I think the stock, you know, the stock price is overvalued. You know, it was overvalued 50% higher, it's still overvalued today. There will be time when I'm in my own Tesla stock. It's gonna be at a very different price.
5 times PE.
Yeah, you know, maybe a little bit higher than that. But actually, by the way, Tesla does.
It is a car company. I don't know if you've looked at other PEs in the auto industry.
It's got a robot and roof tiles.
Oh, sorry, my bad.
Yeah.
Vitaly, this is coming up on time. if folks want to get in contact with you or follow along with what you're doing, how do they do that?
Very simple. I have a very simple website, investor.fm. Like FM radio. Just go there, you can subscribe to my articles. So next time when I write about Tesla and I don't buy the stock, you'll find out about it.
That's great. Thanks for Terry. Thanks,
thank
JT.
You guys, you're so much fun. And by the way, I gotta tell you, this podcast is incredible. You guys are doing a great job. And Jake, seriously, Veggies, gotta be a book. Maybe a different title.
We'll get the foreword out of it, Taylor.
Yeah, there you go.
I would be delighted to.
Thanks, folks. We'll be back next week, same bat time, same bat channel.